I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Upfront. I'm Chloe Morgan.
And I'm Rachel O'Sullivan.
England keep on winning. They're unstoppable and unbeaten in 25 games after another good performance, this time beating Japan in Spain. We'll look into that and also Beth Mead's recent comments, a little bit controversial, and explore the lack of diversity within the Lionesses and what can be done to address this across all levels of the game. Joining us again, a friend of the pod, Dulwich Hamlet, centre-back and head of brand at Football Beyond Borders, sail on Andy Hickman! Woo, woo, woo!
Thanks, guys. Good to be back and good to also be promoted to friend of the pod. Thank
yeah,
you.
We don't give them out easily to everyone who's on it.
Yes. Do you get like a Blue Peter badge or something?
Yeah, we've something similar.
We need to start handing those out, really. We keep saying that we've got these badges and they never really materialise for our guests. So, that'll be something that producer Charlie is looking into ASAP. Thanks, Char. To start off, Ceylon, since we've got you on and it's been such an amazing week for yourself and the Dulwich Hamlet squad and the Red Pepper Army or the Pepper Army? Like, where did this come from?
The Pepper Army. So, not to be confused with the traditional lunchbox snack.
Mm.
Pepper Army. It's two separate words.
Okay,
Pepper,
sorry, that's where I was going there, yeah.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, after the win on Sunday, a Pepper Army was handed to Lucy Monkman, who scored a brace for us from the crowd, which was a nice touch. But no, where does it come from? The Pepper Army came to the game armed with Pepper Armies and then
But they're two different types of
Lucy
Pepper Army.
Pepper Army.
I've never said that word so much.
Yes, so the Pepper, as in chili pepper, spicy pepper, you know, because we used to have a manager who was an amazing man called Farouk, who built AFC Phoenix, which used to be Dulwich. And Farouk used to always talk about playing spicy football. Which then the motive became for the team a chili pepper, and there was an inflated chili pepper that comes to every game with us. And then we brought that into Dulwich Hamlet, and tragically, actually, Farouk lost his life into our first season as Dulwich. And it's sort of his legacy. We've got little chili peppers on the back of our numbers. We talk about playing spicy football. And now recently we've had a new crowd of fans coming down who have cottoned on to this chili pepper, and they started calling themselves the Pepper Army. They've got banners, Pepper Army. I've got it here. Oh, it's not great because it's a podcast, but...
Describe it for
find
us.
You this because,
what a story.
I can describe it, actually.
I know,
there's depth to this, you know. We're not just any old team. This, someone designed. So for listeners,
sick.
It is a Tabasco logo, but that says Dulwich in the middle. It says Pepper Army, and it says Spicy Sundays. So that's the story behind
the
Pepper Army.
Story.
We'll be available on a T-shirt soon.
Amazing. I'm definitely buying one of those. Available in the Upfront shop, coming shortly. Links to follow. I mean, we've got to talk about the amazing weekend that you guys have had. I mean, the crowd, obviously your Pepper Army down there, absolutely doing business for you guys and clearly working, being that 12th man that we all hate the phrase of. Into the second round of the FA Cup, securing that 3-1 win away to Aylesford FC,
wasn't
it?
Kent,
yeah, big game. How was it? I mean, I heard that you didn't get a red card this week, so, you know, credit to you.
Marginal improvements. I think, it's the first time the club have reached the FA Cup first round proper in our history. So then to win it and go on to the second round was massive. And I think we did get a bit of luck of the draw. We got a team in our league already that we'd just be in the league. So we knew that we could beat them, but we also didn't want to come with like, this is going to be a walkover. And it wasn't, because in the first 5 minutes, there was a piece of calamitous defending from yours truly, which ball bounced over my head. Then I went for the block, and I don't know whether I got megged or not. I need to watch it back. But we went 1-0 down. So no red card this time, but atrocious first 5 minutes, and a terrible first half from us as a team. And we equalised just before the break. And I've never been more relieved to go in at half time when it was 1-1. I couldn't have gone into that change room being like, sorry, guys, sorry. Well, I was anyway. But a much, much better second half from the whole team, and a personal improved performance. And yeah, we came out and won 2 goals from Lucy Monkman, 1 from our captain, Britt. And it was beautiful. And when the final whistle went, I think, you don't get to experience those moments often. And the crowd were absolutely amazing. And it got really foggy and they started chanting. It got really misty.
Really
after
spicy.
Half, and they were all going, spooky football, spooky football. And then they started football in a graveyard, football in a graveyard.
What?
And the funny thing is, when the Aylesford came to us in the league a few weeks ago, I think one of their players said to the ref, "Ref, please can you stop the crowd from singing? They're too loud and I can't play football. I can't concentrate."
What?
And the ref was like, "No." So then our fans came to the ground and they were singing, it's too loud, I can't play football.
Oh,
and then
no.
They were doing Bjork, Choir. It was, honestly, they're such trolls. It's brilliant. It was very, very fun. But if you want a fun Sunday, do come down, because it is
100%.
Just vibes.
We've got to get down to one of the games, because
the
atmosphere down at Dulwich Hamlet is sick. And I want to get myself one of your kits as well, because they're just so bloody... They are spicy. That is a bit of spice.
I do think it's probably worth pointing out that this episode is sponsored by Pepper Army. Just...
Nice.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah.
Thanks for the frame rate. I should have done that. I'm not even doing my job properly, am I? I should have done that.
I want those freebies.
You guys, next game against Tier 3 Gillingham in the second round. That's going to be a tough battle. But, I mean, my money's on you guys. Yeah.
I need to get through, Chloe, because I need a Palace Dulwich fixture. That's what we need.
All right.
Imagine battle.
No longer a friend of the
you
pod.
You would come in the third round.
Yeah, we would.
Palace come in the third round.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if we win against Gillingham, we've got there could be an upfront.
There's a
game.
1 to 3,000 chance that we might get to play each other. Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm backing it. I'll do what I can with the FA, try and fix some things.
legally, just, obviously.
Well, match fixing.
Yeah, match fixing and bribery. It's
happens
all,
in the men's game.
I'm all about that life now.
You're a lawyer. You know how to do it the right way.
Anyway. Anyway, before I get myself into massive amounts of trouble and probably an FA investigation, let's move on to a lighter topic. I don't know whether you guys have been watching, you know, latest Jill Scott watch, I'm going to be calling it, on the weekly pods now. It's been a fairly quiet week, I think, for Jill. I mean, obviously, she's been superseded, I think, by the massively dramatic arrival of our most beloved health secretary, Matt Hancock, who seems to be sort of running away with all the trials, people feeding him camel penises and sheep's vaginas and burying him under the floor and setting snakes on him. And it's just been incredible to watch, really. Just a great bit of telly, but also controversially, should he be on the bloody telly on the first place? Ceylon, have you managed to catch much of it at all? I'm a celeb fan.
I'd like to start by saying this was probably the best homework for a podcast I've ever done, being able to watch I'm a Celeb last night and just thinking, this is what I wish I'd had at school. Just watch I'm a Celeb for homework. I've revised because I've watched I'm a Celeb. I have been watching it. It's hard though, isn't it? It's hard to get an hour episode every night of your life. You know, it is a big commitment. But Jill's highlight of the last few days was when Matt became camp leader and was reading out the rules, and she said, just to be clear, are these guidelines or rules?
Gold.
Matt.
Absolute gold.
And I thought, you know what, that political critique, subtle, beautiful from Jill Scott.
The voice of a nation is Jill Scott now. Yeah. Right, I think it's probably about time that we got into talking about some actual football, really.
You're saying Dulwich Hamlet first round of the FA Cup was an actual kind football, of, Chloe.
Cut that out, Charlie, cut that out.
That is foot in mouth, that. I mean,
I'll
not that that's
not on you.
Actual football, but like the big sort of top tier elite.
Oh, you mean the international football?
That's what I meant. Yeah. Mm. The international stuff. Yeah, England, Japan, that one. Please come back to the pod.
I will come and I will bring my pepperami.
That'd be sick. That would be absolutely sick if we had a pepperami in the studio. Although we probably wouldn't talk about anything apart from just how incredible your crowd support is, because we could learn a couple of things from that. But yeah, England 4-0 over Japan. I mean, they're doing all right, and they scored 123 goals, conceded 6, 25 unbeaten games under Serena since she took charge in September 2021. I mean, it was an incredible game. England tested Japan repeatedly, but I mean, their goalkeeper, Yamashita in goal, was unreal. I mean, Rach, you saw the game. What were your thoughts? Because this was an absolute powerhouse performance.
I thought it was amazing because, you know, I know a lot of people have talked about Japan being in transition for, I don't know, years at this stage. But England weren't playing their regular starting 11. We know how much Serena Wiegmann loves her starting 11. There was a lot of changes in this squad, a lot of youngsters in this squad. We talked on the last episode about her calling up some of the youngsters, and they were getting minutes, which was amazing to see. You know, Ebony Salmon, we had Neve Charles, Esme Morgan, Jess Park came on, Lauren James, like, amazing to see so many youngsters get games against a team like Japan, who play generally some unbelievable football, and importantly, a kind of quite a different style of football to maybe something England have come up against under Serena. So she did say in the press conference how important it was for them to play a nation that plays like quite different kind of tactical football. But England were all over them. Like, it was ridiculous. They completely dominated the game, could have been more than 4-0. And more importantly, we saw some youngsters getting the score sheet as well. Like, I mean, this will make you sick, but Jess Park, who scored within 79 seconds with her like first touch of the game, first player to score for the Lionesses who was born in 2001.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's not a great stat. That
no, it's not, is it?
Personally,
I saw that was like great for her, terrible for everyone else older than her. But yeah, it just makes me really excited for what's to come. You know, it makes you feel like the Euros obviously wasn't a one-off, but to know that beyond the World Cup, you've got these youngsters in the squad who understand the style of play that Serena wants to play and have come in and slotted in so well. It's brilliant. It's very, very exciting.
Yeah, I think if anything, I mean, it's that reliance that I think, and the confidence that instills in the squad rotation that Serena has. I mean, you know, you might be sort of a little bit less confident or a little bit sort of, reluctant to kind of put on some of your younger players who might not have had the international game time experience. But I think what that showed by having so many youngsters out on the pitch and then delivering, and not just delivering and scraping a win, delivering in a ridiculously elite style was beautiful to watch. And I think, you know, I've got to touch on the Ebony Salmon 8 goals in 8 games for Houston Dash. I know we don't get to see too much of her, obviously, playing out in the US at the moment, but seeing her come in, Lauren James, again, I mean, she's been flying in the past few weeks. And again, another incredibly dangerous half an hour from her. So, yeah, I mean, Ceylon, did you catch it? What were your thoughts on the game?
Yeah, I watched the highlights. I think there were so many chances, but also what that communicated to me was I think what Rachel said, the seamless transition of that players can come into this system now and deliver the expectation that we all have of watching the Lionesses, the kind of football we want to see, but also what Serena has created. And I think that comes down to the culture that she has built, which feels so progressive and different to what maybe Lioness teams have been in the past. The fact that young players can come into that space now and feel so able to go out there, fit in, take risks, make mistakes, learn from those mistakes and be brave. It's like, that's how you get beautiful football. And I think that's a massive credit to what Serena Wiegmann has built, and something I will not stop talking about, because I think it's just what gives it the edge. The 123 goals, like, you don't get 123 goals in just over a year and concede 6 without playing like brave, risky and fun football. And to do that, you have to feel safe, supported and, yeah, yourself and brave within yourself.
So look, when you speak and the way that you speak and the structure of the sentences that you use, I constantly feel inspired by everything you say.
Like,
over the emotional podcast that we did a couple months back, and it was just it was so powerful. It was so powerful, and I just sat there just in awe, like, oh my god, like, what adjective is gonna come out next? Because it's just, I feel like I can become a lioness now. Stop, I won't be it. Doing that. I've just retired.
I'm going really red. My face has gone really red.
But moving swiftly on, I mean, England play Norway tonight in Spain. That's at, you say, 7 o'clock, right? 7 o'clock at ITV, or 6:30. Basically, tune in from 6:30 and try and find the game at some point on ITV, because it will be another big test for them. But again, I think, I mean, this is looking pretty confident. And again, don't want to speak too quickly about the World Cup chances, but this is looking like a good little foundation, isn't it, team?
Yeah, for sure. Especially get the bleeding in those players now. It's a hard thing to do when you've only got 8 or 9 months to a World Cup. And we talked about it again last week, is it's not just players kind of having to get used to that back-to-back tournament, but also managers and how they, you know, phase out players and bring in players in such a short space of time. And I think it's really exciting that Serena's being able to do that and do that so well.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Well, I mean, the biggest story around the Lionesses this week came off the back of Beth Mead's comments in an interview. Just for a bit of context, guys, I mean, obviously you must have been living under a rock if you've not heard what's been going on. Beth Mead was asked in a Guardian interview if there was a specific reason for a lack of black players in England's squad or if it was coincidental. Mead's response, I think it's completely coincidental. We put out our best 11 and you don't think of anyone's race or anything like that. I think that's more of an outsider's perspective. I'll just stop there for a second. I mean, when I saw those comments come through in the article, I think, I was very on the fence, I think, initially. I think it's difficult. Beth Mead is obviously a massive role model in the game. She does incredible things behind the scenes, inspiring the next generation, obviously, with the Euros win, and just being an all-round lovely person. And sometimes lovely people say the wrong things and get things wrong. And when they do, obviously, the consequences can be quite huge. But then that person then becomes a bit of a sort of token of how not to do things, or they sort of get vilified for that. So I did feel a little bit sorry for her. I think obviously she's not really thought about the comments that she's made and the impact that that could have. That it seems to come from a lack of understanding, lack of education on the issues. But I also appreciate she's been incredibly bloody busy, and it does take a lot of time to get to a place and space where you are educated, and that is on the players to do that, especially given their status in the Lionesses squad and the impact that they can have. But it's I mean, guys, what were your thoughts on it? Because it's difficult, because she's not intentionally tried to cause any harm with the comments that she's made. It just shows a bit of ignorance for me.
I think her comments weren't the issue, but they're an example of the issue that needs to be tackled and addressed. And I think, as you said, they do represent a lack of understanding. And, you know, many have said that her comments could be interpreted that she assumed the question meant the senior team. But for me, the first comments came out, I was disappointed, right? As Ian Wright and Annie Aluko said, they were clumsy, disappointing. And I'm sure, for me, I'm more disappointed about the follow-up comments on Sky Sports. And while I appreciate that she has had some pretty terrible abuse on social media, because what else is this platform for? I think she should have started her answer to Sky with an apology, without question. Whether or not she meant what she said, or it was taken out of context, or it doesn't reflect her beliefs properly, which I'm sure is the case, in this, you know, accountability is so important. And the words, yes, they were clumsy, and you need to recognise that they hurt people. And I think recognising that would have gone an awful long way. And then she could have followed up with, it's not what I meant, it doesn't reflect my beliefs, fine. But accountability, first and foremost, for me, would have gone an awful long way.
So I think when I saw it, there was the immediate instinctive reaction of, oh no, another white player has completely misunderstood the context, the nuance, the challenges that face young girls of colour and the progression into elite football. That's been compounded by the fact they haven't exposed themselves enough to, I don't know, critical race theory, or thought more enough about whiteness and how whiteness manifests and how people get defensive and all these kind of things. So there was like that issue. But then I also, when I read it, I thought there's two interpretations here. There's one in good faith, when we didn't have a Sky Sports interview. The one looking at it in good faith is she's asked, do you think there's a problem with racism in selection? Or, you know, do you think, and she's gone, no, of course not. We pick the best players. We don't choose the players because they're black, and choose the players because they're white, which is a really flattening, pretty like baseless response to a question, right? That's naive in terms of it. But that was like the good interpretation. Yeah, well, completely one-dimensional, but that's a good faith interpretation. Oh, they've asked her that, and she's gone, of course it's not. Serena's not racist. She doesn't pick white players over black players. The bad faith argument is that it's a complete disregard that the issue exists, and goes, oh no, of course, if you're black, you can get into elite football. And I just got there because not anything because of my privileges, because I live and have grown up in a white body. Like they're the two, good faith, bad faith. Whatever happened there, the underpinning thread that goes through that is that it's a complete lack of understanding and how the issue manifests and how we get to systems where we have all white 11s playing for England and the complexities that come into that. And also, too, just a very poor preparation from her part and her team on how to handle questions like that in the media. If you are doing a book tour, you have spoken about social issues already. You've gone on one of the biggest radio shows in the country, BBC Women's Hour, and you've talked about Qatar and LGBTQ rights. Fair play to you. That also means you can't pick your struggles. You can't just choose your struggles. That means you have to be there willing to put your neck out for your black players who in your teammates, for the black girl who wants to play for the Lionesses and doesn't see herself in the team at the moment, for the black parent who may not be able to get their daughter into a football team because they've got loads of other things going on in their life or their world is completely different to your white parents' world. And you have to do the work to say, I know that question's going to come. This is what my take is and this is my allyship. Not flatten the discussion and move on and say, oh, no, that's not what I meant. I think that was my issue with what she said. But following that, the hearing that Wrighty rang her up and had that conversation, that's progress. We can't vilify and then keep someone in a box and say you can't learn, therefore you represent this. The fact that he's had that phone call, she's listened, they've had a conversation. Who else do you trust more in that space to do that from a friendly perspective? So for me, that's a beautiful outcome of what's happened. But the damage that was done in her initial comments, I think is, yeah, she needed to come out and apologise. But maybe she felt like, actually, I was shoved into a corner with a question that I didn't really quite understand. And of course, I'm not a racist, so I'm going to say that, but that is the problem with whiteness. I'll stop there.
Yeah, yeah. But also, you've got people around you. For me, that was the other frustration, is you've got a PR team, you've got the FA in those circumstances who you would expect to help you come up with a more robust answer. And if you didn't have that in the initial question, you should have it. You know you're going to get asked about it again. And, you know, the FA says they're doing the work and you know, they've got lots of programs and everything, which is great, but that also includes educating your players. And in that circumstance, they had an opportunity to say to Beth, here's how we respond to this, and should have had a more robust answer with accountability.
Yeah, and part of the FA's strategy is, yes, there's Discover My Talent, there's all these programs and investment and moving RTCs around and all that sort of thing, which we can come on to. But part of the FA strategy should make sure that your white players are really, really well brushed up and well versed to speak about an issue that whether they chose it or not, they represent, because they're white and they step out on a pitch with 10, maybe 9 sometimes when one of the black players starts, white players, and they represent something there, and they have to be educated, well read, listen to an audiobook. There's so many at the moment that you can listen to really understand how these things come about, and that therefore is part of the FA's work in supporting this, because then a black player doesn't, or a young black girl or a black parent doesn't have to listen to Beth Mead's comments and actually hears a lot of Lotta Moy or Aaliyah Williamson being an ally, and they go, oh, of course my daughter can go into this, or of course I can see myself in this space because there's people like that represent me.
No, massively. And I think even things like, you know, obviously a lot of the women's teams are now, you know, taking the knee. I mean, in the WSL and Championship, they're still taking the knee. And I think, you know, making comments like that kind of suggests to me that you don't really understand what the gestures that you're doing at the start of the game really represent or mean. Which begs the question, why are you doing it in the first place if you've not done that kind of research? But I do think, you know, from a player perspective, and this might sound a little bit controversial given that I'm obviously mixed race, but in terms of kind of the expectation of players to constantly know or to have a great deep understanding of a lot of the societal issues going on. So things like the LGBTQ plus situation in Qatar and taking the knee and, you know, these... Is it too much, I think, with the training schedule, the match schedule that you have, to be constantly told that you've got to be a role model for all of these different issues and topics that might come up from a gender perspective, a sort of race perspective, sexuality perspective? It's because that takes a lot of work. That takes a lot of work. And it's only very recently that I think these kind of topics have been given a lot of attention. So it's a lot of work to be doing in quite a short space of time. I know that's a controversial question and I'm only asking it to pose some discussion.
No, bear with. I think that's fair. But it wasn't long ago that people were uncomfortable speaking about LGBTQ plus rights and equality in the game. And now we see lots of players doing it, lots of media and those involved in the game willing to speak out, willing to use their platforms. And we've got allies comfortable to talk openly about the issue and clubs doing rainbow armbands and, you know, rainbow days and laces day. And I'd like to see the game get to a point where people can speak as widely and as comfortably about race and diversity in the game. And that's myself included. You know, I want to be better using our platform to speak about that. I think there's a bit of an issue in how and when we talk about diversity and race, and whether that be in the media or on social media, we need to be doing it more. Like Ian Wright said it perfectly, it's a systematic problem and we just deal with it in incidents. So we end up, generally the topic comes up when something has negatively happened, whether it's an inappropriate comment or something has been said, and suddenly we get, you know, the issue then is highlighted and everyone starts talking about it on social media and there's a big drive to make change. For me, we need to talk about it positively, regularly. You know, we should be sharing the initiatives that are taking place that are trying to tackle the lack of a diversity, the progress being made, the stories of the amazing people in the game doing amazing work. And we should be elevating those people doing that work and elevating their stories. And I think that creates a more positive environment for people to feel they can speak. Because, you know, rather than this, there's a lot of energy when something negative is said, but we need that same energy regularly, positively, to talk about the discussion, because that's how we're going to educate people and that's how we're going to foster an environment where people feel they can comfortably speak on it.
I'm gonna go hard on this one, Clara.
This is what we want. This is what we want.
You've been taking notes.
Big takes, come on.
I saw that, writing stuff down. I was like, oh my God, okay, you've got something to say. Let's get it out.
Number one, my first point, premise of this argument is that I'm operating on the assumption that professional players in the WSL do have time. Yes, they train, they have matches, but, you know, I always think if I was at the top of the game, I'd, you know, learn Spanish or something. You know, you've got so many hours where you're just chilling.
But I would say with, you know, the lionesses and the profile they have, it is a lot of, you know, fulfilling sponsorship, partnership agreements, a lot of media appearances, a lot of going into schools, things like that. And especially sort of in the lead up into the Women's World Cup, they will be asked to do countless things and also getting your recovery and rest time in, mental and physical, just on that point.
So hear that. But I think if you're going to do the sponsorship work, and if you're going to do the platform and the being a spokesperson for the game, then you've got to do the work yourself
and write a book
beforehand. Yeah, exactly. If you've got time to write a book, you've got time to read some James Baldwin, all right? I think that's what I'm saying. But I think it's about where the burden falls in this argument. Because of the system that we're in, that only a few black girls make it to the top at the moment, they then therefore have a huge burden of responsibility to represent all black girls and to show every single black girl growing up there, and brown girls. We don't see any brown girls in the team at the moment, but they are. You have to be the person that represents all of these people. You can't put a foot wrong. So you're, I guess, the burden on your shoulders to represent and to get things right is huge, because you're representing so much more than just yourself. And that is an unfair burden at the moment compared to what the white players have. Therefore, I think the burden needs to be lifted and split across a lot more of the white players' shoulders, which they grow up, they're going to have to do more work, because they grow up in a country that denies its colonial history, that denies its institutional racism, that teaches us in school that actually the East India Company was great in history because we brought tea and worked with the Indians to build tea. No, actually, we enslaved a lot of people and killed a lot of people on the premise that British was better than everyone else in the world. That's the education that you get in school, because it's so narrow. Therefore, you're not exposed to black literature. Michael Gove literally took anything that wasn't English or American literature off the GCSE English curriculum when he was the education secretary. So you don't get an exposure into, you know, African writers or Caribbean writers. You don't have that experience. So therefore you have to individualize that work going forward. You are a product of the system that you've moved through unless you expose yourself to other things. So if you're going to be at the top of your game and have such a profile, if you're going to write a book, go on the media, represent something, you have to have done the work. So it doesn't always fall on the black players' shoulders, and that you can go out there and speak confidently and say, I think part of the issue in all of this, to Rachel's point, is that we don't speak about it enough in the right ways, because people are fearful because they haven't learned enough, or they haven't spent enough time like immersing themselves in the different nuances of these debates. And if they did and learned some things, I think there's what the one thing, if anyone's listening to this podcast and they say, where do I start? There is a book that came out this year. It's called A New Formation, How Black Footballers Shaped the Modern Game. And it's by Callum Jacobs. And it's a series of different writers. They're all writers of colour. and they pick different players. There's an essay on Hope Powell, and there's an essay on Anita Asante, but there's also lots of different black players throughout. And it's so much better than the original, the conversation that race in football is reduced to, which is about incidents of racism and when people get it wrong. That's what we talk about in football. This is a really nuanced description of like blackness, whiteness, how it manifests in different spaces. And there's so much learning in there. That's like a really good place to go and start about this.
Again, every time you speak,
yeah,
the inspiration.
Can you do an audiobook?
Yeah, honestly,
the upfront audiobook coming too soon.
But I think off the back of what you're saying, I think the only thing that I have a little bit of sympathy thought with in terms of what Beth Mead has said is that sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And I think for me, I think for her, that will have highlighted that there's a blind spot for her in terms of what she didn't know and now will be very much aware of. And I think, like you said, I think you have to take that in isolation and appreciate that, you know, people will make mistakes, they will move on. And it looks like she has learned from that and is now having these great discussions with Serena, with Ian Wright, and maybe trying to better educate herself for examples where she will be asked about it in future. And I hope that's also something that the other lionesses and other WSL championship clubs, national clubs, all clubs, will kind of take on board that they need to start to educate their players or make them aware that these types of issues are relevant, do need to be discussed. And, you know, I mean, potentially that is something that the FA should be looking at in terms of, you know, when you are stepping into roles where you're getting more visibility and you are going to be in the media some more, that you should be, you know, given some more training, education about what your thoughts, so you can develop your own thoughts and ideas on this situation based on your own experiences. Because I don't see that happening. Like when you do coaching badges, there's sort of a diversity module and you have to have that module and have to have that education to step up to the next level. It's a very small, tiny, tiny module. But I feel like that should be something that should be adopted by players because I think they're going to be asked these questions more and more. But I think from your perspective, obviously, Ceylon, you do a lot of work in this area. And in terms of accessibility, just sort of for our listeners' perspective, what kind of issues do you see at, you know, grassroots level going up into academy, RTCs from your players?
It's still so many and they're the ones that are wheeled out a lot, I guess, now the conversation is much broader on the problem of race in women's football since the Euros, I'd say. And I always remember it was 4 years ago and I took the group I talked about in the last podcast, the Lanfranc girls, the GCSE Results Day girls.
Oh, don't start that again, we'll be in bits. I can't.
They were in year 7 and year 8 and I took them to England, Australia at Craven Cottage. And it was their first FPB trip. And they were so excited. They were like making loads of noise outside the stadium, as you all saw during the Euros. And we got them in the stadium and I sat with a few of them. And Jemima, one of the girls, a black girl, turned around to me and said, where are all the black players? And I was like, it's a really good question, Jemima. She was like, there's one and she's wearing an Australian shirt and she's not even on the pitch. And I was like, it's a really good question. Let's talk about that. And yeah, we spoke about why that was and what in her lived experience maybe thought that she could or couldn't be a footballer or allowed her, both in what she sees of the game, but also her material conditions and the way that she can move through the world as a 12-year-old or 13-year-old who might want to play football. And I think if you take a black girl from South London who has grown up in a working class community, whose mum or dad or parent or carer works multiple jobs and doesn't have maybe a car, then if your 12-year-old girl comes home from school one day and says, oh, I want to go and play football in this club, and it's like, okay, well, how do we get to this club? Oh, it's 2-3 buses to maybe Dulwich from Peckham, where you have to go, you know, go whatever. It's 7:30 kickoff at training till 9 p.m. Okay, cool. Well, how is that 12-year-old going to get there? Mum's working 7:30 till 11. You getting on the bus as a 12-year-old in a city, probably not all right. It's got dark, so I don't really feel comfortable with you being out there. You may or may not have credit on your phone, which means that you are safe and can call someone. So actually, no, we're going to say no on this occasion. Maybe in the summer you can play again. Like, that's the kind of things. And then you, that's just at a very micro grassroots level. You've got excited about football in school and you want to keep playing outside of school. Then if you're thinking, well, that player is actually really, really good, Right, well, where's the step up for them? Where's the RTC? Where's the club with a pathway for them? And the problem, which has been really widely reported, is that RTCs have moved out of city centres, basically, and they're not in these urban areas where lots of girls of colour are growing up. So then, therefore, they're out in Cobham or they're in Boreham Wood or whatever, and they have to get out there for Chelsea and Arsenal. I've just described getting from Dulwich to, from Peckham to Dulwich on a bus, which anyone who knows South London is about 10 minutes on a bike. It's really, really, really difficult. And I think that's, at a very, very basic level, what's happening.
No, I've got to agree with that. And I think, I mean, that was something that I was at a London Youth Sport Network event on Friday. And we were sort of talking about some of the issues around, you know, how we increase Black participation in sports and the kind of barriers and challenges to that. And you pretty much echoed my point. I mean, if you've got a child who's in a situation where it looks like they've got some serious potential there, you know, the chance of them getting to Cobham or, you know, getting somewhere like Boreham Wood, in which the both of them in the arse end of nowhere, are very, very slim. And that's only going to limit their opportunity and limit their chances. I mean, and you're also talking about you're going to have to need to have a parent or guardian who is able to take you there, who doesn't have the work commitments that they do, who also has a car, who or can also afford the petrol 4 or 5 times a week to take you there, and the boots and the gloves and the kit, and take you to the away days as well, which could be Southampton, Portsmouth, Brighton, any of those places. So that's your entire weekend gone as well. And I think the fear that I have, I think, seeing players come up, is that the game is going to become very elitist, and it's only going to be those players who can essentially be able to pay to play, to have those opportunities, because you need that infrastructure, you need that family support or friend support or whatever it is, and that home environment to be able to access those things. And a lot of kids aren't in that position.
And I think at this point in the discussion, it's really important to zoom out and take a step back and say, because it's really dangerous that you get into pathologizing the issue onto certain bodies and saying, well, Black people are poor in this country, or brown people are poor in this country, whatever. And I think you have to zoom out there and say, obviously there are lots of instances where that isn't the case. And there's also lots of instances where young children growing up from working class households are white, of course.
Oh, massively. I think that situation is not so much a racial one as a socioeconomic one.
Exactly.
But yeah, and I completely agree.
So that's when you have to zoom out and you do what Ian Wright said, where you say, let's look at the systemic and beyond football. Why is it that we live in a country where if you are Black, you are more likely to be growing up in that environment, to be growing up in areas of low socioeconomic advantage and growing up in poverty or having to work multiple jobs? And that's the question. It's like, because this country has a terrible history of race and it has a lot of institutional racism baked into how it operates and how it works. And I think, you know, you for a player, like, if we go back to that point about Beth Mead, you have to be aware of this full context and how the macro and what's going on at a national global scale because of deep-rooted history and how the economy has been set up in this country impacts then the lived experience of a 12-year-old Black girl from South London or South Birmingham or South Manchester or wherever she might be growing up in a city, and how she got there and how she came to be, and then work out, well, what might be the barriers for her stopping football. And I think that's the thing that we often miss in this discussion is, you know, when we're lobbying Liz Truss or trying to say get girls football on the girls' curriculum, let's also draw attention to why do we have to lobby Liz Truss in this, because maybe I'm going too deep here, but systemic policy decisions have relegated certain bodies to financial positions in this country. And that's something that needs to be addressed and also or even aware of when we're talking about this.
Bringing it back to the women's football world, if you like, it's just not offered to girls in the same way that it's offered to boys, first and foremost. So in terms of a lot of these training facilities, as you said, these RTCs, these centres of excellence, like that do exist, are just not in urban areas. They're pushed out on the edges of urban areas. I mean, just look at half the grounds that these WSL teams play in. Like, they're miles away from the main stadia, first and foremost. It's so it ends up from top down, it's harder to access women's football. So if you haven't got the financial support to actually do that, you know, a lot of the stories that we hear from players coming up in the game, or maybe established in the game now, talk about the hours and hours that their parents took, having to drive them all ends of the earth to get to football and to train. So if you haven't got that kind of level of financial support, like, it's just it's a difficult thing to do anyway, but it's made all the more difficult by the fact that the game is already, you know, difficult to reach.
Just to illustrate Rachel's point with a story, I used to work in a boys' school in Peckham, State Boys' School near Queen's Road, and I'd finish an FBB session, I'd come out on the road, and there'd be about four or five nice black cars basically lined up, taxis, and I always used to be like, oh, what are they for? And they were Brighton Football Club sending cabs to Peckham at the end of school to pick up some boys to then drive them down to Brighton for training. And they did that multiple times a week because those boys were a commodity, because those boys were valuable. They needed to develop them because there's a business in men's football, right? And there isn't the same thing in women's football. So if I was working in another school in Peckham down the road and I have one girl there who was like incredible, she's her name's Luna, she's been on the South of the River documentary on Netflix now, she's 16 now, when she was 12 years old I'm like, you are insane, we need to get you into a team. And for her, there was no car, there was no WSL club willing to come and pick her up from school at the end of the day. And that for me is the really pronounced difference in, because of the money and the investment that we have in the men's game, those boys were able to do that. And perhaps part of the reason that the England team is so much more representative of this country that we live in the men's side, whereas in the women's side, that's a parent who's having to pick you up at the end of the day and probably sacrifice on income to be able to take that time out to pick you up, to drive you 4 hours and back there and back to Brighton to play that game or be in that training session.
I think, I mean, that's obviously feeding a little bit into sort of intersectionality, because I think obviously the treatment of, you know, black and white players are there completely different. The treatment of men's and women's players are completely different. Girls and boys players are completely different, obviously based on the financial resources and also what the club are willing to invest, given, like you said, how much of a commodity they are and how much of an investment they are sort of later down the line. But I think obviously the issues aren't just in accessibility, it's also in the sort of treatment of non-white players once they get to the sort of higher levels. I think, you know, based on my own experiences, I was one of the very few when I was doing my WSL year who were in the WSL. I think there was only a handful of players at best at that time. And I think in the squad of, 22, 23 of us at Spurs, it was only myself, Becky Spencer, Jess Naz, I think, out of a squad of 23 players. And bearing in mind, we're a London-based club. London's obviously a very diverse, multicultural city. But to have, just over 10% of your players coming from non-white backgrounds, I think, you know, you do look around and you are like, well, where the hell is, how has this happened? How have I got here? How have other people not got here? And I think my route into sort of elite football was a little bit more different, because I'd never expected that I'd ever be in elite football to start with, and it just sort of happened through a series of very lucky promotions. But I think we started off back in the sort of the national side when we were in the National League, being a fairly diverse squad. I think it was probably about half and half in terms of black and mixed race Asian players that we had. And then as soon as we started to get promoted, you did see a dropping off of those players. And this is not me saying, oh, okay, there's a systemic racism problem in Spurs at all. That's really not where I'm going with this. But there was a complete lack of diversity the higher up in the sort of ranks we got. And then you get into WSL and you find that actually you look around and you are one of the only few players to get there. And I think I've got to touch on, obviously, the Enea Luko situation a few years ago. I mean, her experiences of being at the elite level, she obviously had quite a few issues with the case that she brought against the FA. Mark Sampson, wasn't it, at the time? But she was reportedly portrayed as an angry black woman throughout her time with the England squad. And this was around 2017. And I think her issue was that there was a sort of stereotype around black players that they were seen as aggressive, or that they were challenging to manage or to coach in some way. And I know Hope Powell as well also felt that she suffered this kind of stereotyping as being a more difficult manager or coach. I wonder if you guys had any sort of thoughts on that perspective from the sort of treatment of players.
I think obviously your lived experience is really important in this, Chloe, but I think what I've seen in terms of there's an interesting, maybe a hidden phenomenon that happens that people aren't really aware of. And I think that is when black leaders create spaces or in any environment in life, I think that a black person is led by a black leader, and obviously I'm a white person, so please just come in and tell me if this is wrong at any point. But like, there's a lot of theory on this as well around like cultural signifiers and things that say, are, you know, we're part of the same community, whether it's hair or diet or things that happen in culture that make you feel closer to people, make you feel like you, it's okay to be yourself in this space. And I think the example I would use in Callum Jacob's book, actually, the essay on Ian Wright, he says at Palace he was one of very few black players, but when he moved to Arsenal there was like five or six of them in the changing rooms, and he talks about that, but that moment and that team being one of the most joyous periods of his life because he finally felt like he could be himself, because it was like permissible to be black and to be proudly black in that space. And I think what then happens in white-led spaces, we don't really realize it because as white people, because we're just like, oh, this is how I've always lived life, because most of the spaces that I move through in my life are led by white people, or the society I live in has been led by white people. And so therefore, when a black player comes into that space, they're like, oh, you know, they might not get things about my hair or about my food or about my family or about all these kind of things. So I have to kind of minimize myself and fit into this white environment. Whereas if you have a black coach or a black leader, suddenly there's already maybe, and maybe I'm reducing it or flattening it too often, but my assumption would be that there is more of a space to be like, cool, I see myself in this space and I can be fully myself with all the different parts of my tradition and my culture, and therefore I can play better or feel like I can be here longer. And perhaps if you look at the England men's team, you see some of the white players like Mason Mount, Jack Grealish, all these people, they've been around black people for a lot of their careers and their time. And I think maybe that is also that's a stark difference, I would say, to the Lionesses team, where it's like predominantly white led always has been. And I think maybe there's some, I don't know, Chloe, if that speaks to any of your experiences in football teams and who you've been led by.
No, massively. I think the majority of my kind of elite career in Championship and in WSL, I've always been managed by white coaches, had white managers, predominantly white teams. Even the sort of backroom staff in terms of, you know, strength and conditioning, physios, always been predominantly white staff. And that's not a criticism anyway, because I've never felt uncomfortable with any of those staff. So it's not a sort of, I don't want to sit here and say, oh, that was a really bad thing, I had some really bad experiences. I didn't. I had really positive experiences with that. But I think the older you get as well, you do start to appreciate that, you know, you are only one of a few, and you do start to sort of ask those questions. Because I think when you do grow up in predominantly white environments, I mean, the area that I grew up in was very white. My school was very white. My work in law is very white. Football is very white. So you kind of get used to those environments, so you don't challenge it because it is the norm. And it's only very recently, and I know it sounds maybe stupid and naive for me to say as a mixed race player, but really only off the back of, you know, what happened a couple of years ago with George Floyd and people really starting to pay attention to the race agenda, that it was something that I started to pick up on. Like, why did I have that experience? When they said that, what did that actually mean? Or why am I one of the only people here? So for me, my own race education has been very recent. And I do look back now at my experiences and sort of question and challenge why certain things took place, and question why, you know, when I have the goalkeeper coaching camps with the company that I've got, why the predominant, like literally 95% of the kids who turn up, 96%, 7% of those girls are white. And despite me being mixed race, gay, female, I still find that there is a certain type of sort of player that will turn up to these camps. So, yeah, there's a lot of amazing discussions happening at the moment, but I've got to agree that it's they're difficult questions to ask yourself, and I understand and appreciate the FA are doing some things to try and rectify that. I know they're doing the sort of 100 coaches program, trying to increase diversity at the coaching levels, try and sort of, you know, you can't see it, you can't be it if you can't see it type thing. But I do think a lot of that does come down to, again, what you were talking about, Ceylon, is accessibility and these girls, you know, being able to have those access to those opportunities, because that's the biggest barrier. Yeah.
I think the other thing, like, we talk a lot about the external work that's going on, the programs and stuff like that, but the same level of work needs to go on internally in these organizations and these clubs. It's not just about look, we'll put on these sessions or whatever it is. Like, there needs to be stuff done internally with the people who work in these organizations from top to bottom. You know, you need to be educating your internal staff, because for me, going out and saying stuff publicly needs to properly reflect the people who work there, and you need everyone bought in and educated into what you're saying. So yeah, it's great that the FA are doing these programs, but I do hope that there is an element of education going on internally with staff, because, you know, I obviously don't have the lived experience you have or as much experience internally in football, but from my old work, you know, which was in a policing setup, that was my biggest issue was, and I worked in comms, was the real desire to start doing loads of stuff publicly. And I'm like, well, we need to get our house in order first, and we need everyone to be, you know, understanding these issues and supporting the work that we're doing before we start trying to tell everyone, look how great we are. It's like, we all need to put in the work. It's not just kind of these external programs, but all the internal stuff as well.
All right, this weekend, Arsenal v Man U, Saturday at 5:30 is obviously a game that I'll be watching, following Man United's journey to their first title. guys, will you be watching this game? I'm assuming, Rach, you're coming back from the US to see that one up front, aren't you? Of course you are.
Yeah. I will be there, yeah. Looking forward to it. Big, big clash at the Emirates. I think they said there's over 33,000 tickets sold already. Do you know what? I was so wrong with the Manchester-Chelsea game. So I'm not even sure I should even bother trying to predict this. But I think there's been a few injuries over the international break. So for me, it's very much who comes back fit, what teams are starting. I imagine Mark Skinner will have learned a lot from the Chelsea game, which perhaps we'll see implemented in the Arsenal game. So really, again, a tough one to call.
All right, flagpole in the sand. Arsenal Man United score, we'll be saying. Oh, you're going to go for a draw?
I didn't say that. Let me think. Oh. Go to Ceylon. Let me think.
All right, Ceylon, you'll be catching up with the game. Are you going to be down there or just watching it? Or
I will be there. And I'm saying it will be 2-1 Arsenal.
Oof. Okay, bold. I like that. No hesitation. Straight in. This is what's happening. Rach, you could sort of learn a few lessons from that. Go on.
All right, Jesus. I was going to say 2-1 Arsenal, but now I'll just say I'm copying her. So 3-2 Arsenal.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm obviously not going to sit on the fence and go completely the opposite direction. I'm going to go 2-1 Man United at the Emirates, which is absolutely bloody ridiculous, even by my standards. But miracles do happen, and Man United have got to take down one of the big beasts at some point this season, so it's going to be this
Agreed.
Weekend.
It could very well be.
All right, gang, thank you so much for the discussion. That's been really insightful and lovely to hear from both of you on your own experiences. I think it's time for us to wrap up, really. I mean, we've been talking now for about... It's near enough an hour. That was chunky. Thanks so much for listening to Upfront. If you've got any questions for us, hit us up on Twitter. I am at Morgie_89. Rach is at Girls on the Ball. And Ceylon is at Ceylon Andy. And that is I, not Y. We'll see you next week.
Upfront is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes. I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly. Seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.